People, not things. The enigma of Chris Crawford. I have always been a fan of Chris Crawford. To me, he is probably one of the first indie developers, even though he spent some time inside the corporate walls of Atari Inc. Crawford has often worked in the margins on experiences that, in a word, are different, either in design, approach, play mechanics, or a combination of all three. I knew of Crawford in his Atari days, and even then, as a kid, his work struck me as singular, unique, and fascinating when I played his games in the 80s, read his various articles and magazines, and generally associated him with good thoughts about Atari Inc. from the Golden Age. In 2005, after reading his book on game design, I invited Crawford to come to my place of work and give a fascinating and thrilling seminar on game design for our development team. After the talk over dinner, I told him how much I loved his work and how it had inspired me to make games, but that, as of yet, decades later, I had never made anything I was proud of. Over a plate of orange chicken, Crawford said these words to me that inspired me for the rest of my life. 20 years is a long time, Steve. What's stopping you from making the game that's in your head? The answer was nothing. And 8 months later, I created the first of a series of web games played tens of millions of times. I still point to that singular moment of inspiration over dinner, where a simple but motivating thought helped me turn my game development dreams into reality. So back in June of this year, it was heartbreaking to read these words on Crawford's longtime blog, Erasmataz.com. He said this, "I failed. It's time to throw in the towel and leave interactive storytelling to others. I don't think that the world is ready."
Into the vertical blind, generation Atari. Into the vertical blind, generation Atari.
In 2020, Jeff and I recorded an unreleased podcast to be named Thankful for Chris Crawford that was never finished. Here is how we described Chris Crawford's effect on us as Atari fans.
Can I tell you something I'm thankful for?
What are you thankful for, Steve?
I'm thankful for world-renowned Atari game designer Chris Crawford.
I'm thankful for Chris Crawford, too.
But why are you thankful for Chris Crawford?
I'm thankful for him to use American vernacular for of the Atari.
Of to me,
D-Ray Atari.
Is that his book?
Yeah.
I'll tell you that there was a time when, to me, Chris Crawford and Atari were like one and the same.
Yeah, you didn't separate those two.
Because one of the names I saw on a couple different games for the Atari 800 was Chris Crawford. Chris Crawford's Eastern Front, Chris Crawford's Excalibur, and his name showed up on the title screen in a way that hardly any other name showed up associated with Atari games.
Yeah, when you saw that name, you knew something quality was there. It was not going to be an arcade game. It was going to be a quality game, and we weren't playing arcade. We weren't buying computers to play arcade games,
no.
Although we did.
We bought an Atari 800. We wanted to play a computer to play games that weren't arcade games. We
right.
wanted in-depth games because we played enough little twitchy stuff on our 2600. We wanted actually nothing to do with it. We wanted to be grown up and play grown-up games at 15 years old.
Right,
or
exactly.
What we were describing here was Chris Crawford as our Atari computer game hero. What happened to Chris Crawford? I went back to look at his career and try to figure it all out. When Chris Crawford started at Atari in 1979, he began working on an Atari 2600 game, The Unreleased Wizard, an unremarkable maze game that was more of a tech demo than anything else. Coming off his previous pre-Atari computer games, Tanktics and Legionnaire, Crawford found the VCS too limiting of a canvas for his creative pursuits. I interviewed Chris Crawford in 2008, and this is what he had to say about programming Wizard.
Well, you know, it's a very difficult machine to program. You had 128 bytes of RAM and 2K of ROM space, and the video display was driven by the CPU. 6502. And so basically, most of your code consisted of the drawing code. You drew it one scan line at a time. So basically, you'd frantically load up the registers, the display registers, with the display data, and then you, for one scan line, and then you had to load up the registers with the display data for the next scan line, and you had exactly, I think it was 76 machine cycles in which to do this, or on average about 35 assembly language commands.
So Crawford was relieved when he got to work on the Atari 400 and 800 computer systems later that year. It gave him the opportunity to flex more creative muscle on a much more capable canvas. Crawford's first few games for the Atari 800 showed signs of an auteur, even if they were more pedestrian in concept. Energy Czar, a game about energy subsidies and pollution for the Atari 8-bit, was originally designed so complicated and opaque as to make sure players read the manual, RTFM, as he liked to say. Crawford felt he was teaching the players a lesson, until Crawford, with help of his manager Dale Yoakum, came to his senses and made it easier to play. In my interview, Crawford described his time working on the Atari 8-bit group like this.
I basically ended up with one, two, three, four different jobs at Atari. My first job was as a Stella programmer, and that lasted 3 months. I wrote one program for Stella, the Wizard, and then I was transferred over to the Home Computer Applications group, where I was programming the home computer, and that lasted about 10 months.
Is that where you made Energy Czar?
Energy Czar and Scram were both done during that time. And then I was promoted to supervisor of a new group, the Software Development Support Group. Our job was to provide technical support to outside programmers.
Scram, also for the Atari 8-bits, is a game about running a nuclear reactor. It was pretty straightforward as a game, and the difference in it came years later in his book On Game Design, which I used as a reference source for much of this essay, when Crawford analyzed the game with naked observations from hindsight. He said this, "If I had to do it all over again, I would start my design process by asking myself, what is fun and interesting about nuclear power plants? And the answer, of course, would be not much, and I would walk away from building such a game." Eastern Front, another 8-bit game. It's an ironic design, where the joystick and a scrolling map offer easy access into a beautiful computer game about the Western Front in World War II. Crawford described Eastern Front like this.
Eastern Front was the classic example of technological opportunism. The way many games are designed nowadays, which I'm very critical of technological opportunism. I did it back then. The Atari 800 had this wonderful scrolling capability, and I developed a little scrolling map thing just to show off to people all this wonderful capability, and I remember telling Joel Billing at SSI and a number of other people, boy, think of the war game you could make with this. And when I tried to interest war game people in using it, they kind of blew me off. So just on the side, on my own, nights and weekends, I started saying, well, okay, let's see if we can add some units here and move them around. And basically, just one thing led to another, and I ended up with a war game.
When I played Eastern Front, I found it a fun and engaging game, but also a bit of a put-on. The game is impossible to win, according to me. Oh, it can be won, mind you. But to me, playing it, it felt like a facade, like art, like Crawford had designed a game that was impossible to win to teach us a lesson about the Western Front in World War II. And by combining an easy user interface and nice graphics to a game that was so hard as to be impossible, he seemed to be sending a message. The point of Eastern Front was not to play. The game was a top seller for Atari and cemented Crawford as an ace early computer game designer.
Yeah, basically, I showed it to the Atari people, the marketing people, and they said, oh, geez, this will never sell. It's a war game. You can put it in the Atari Program Exchange. And I put it there, and it was a huge hit. And so the next year, they said, why don't you do a new version for us that we'll do as an official Atari product?
In 2020, I sent Crawford a message on Facebook about Eastern Front and asked him point blank if it had been designed in a somewhat subversive way to make a point. For that unreleased podcast in 2020, I recited his response.
Chris Crawford's entire career has been somewhat subversive, right? So I texted him on Facebook and I asked, hey, Chris, did you make Eastern Front in a way that was sort of subverted expectations? And he texted me back and he said, yes, absolutely. Eastern Front is unwinnable. You cannot actually win the game. It even says that in the instructions. He made a war game where you play the Nazis where you can't win specifically to prove a point.
Right.
That the Nazis could win.
After this response, it was proven to me what I always felt in my gut. Crawford had been striving his entire career to make a game that tells a story far beyond the subject matter, with context between the lines. I realize that this is always in the eye of the beholder, but to me, he has been trying to create art. After Eastern Front, Crawford was recruited into Atari Research in late 1981. He was recruited by the legendary Alan Kay, who was Atari chief scientist from 1981 to 1984, who previously had led the design of the GUI interface, the Dynabook, and other foundational computer inventions, some of them while working at Xerox PARC. Kay's instructions for Crawford were to dream. To dream. This is when Crawford's game designs took a dramatic turn towards the interesting, artistic, and independent. Armed with the thought that computer games now are about things, not people, he set out to design a game about people, not things. The first result of this was Gossip, a game about social interactions where the win state is when you get enough people to like you. The manual describes how to win this way. The game is very different from other games. You have to be very sneaky to win. First, your goal is to make the boys like you better than any of the other girls. Can't blast the other girls with laser blasters or hyperwarp them to another galaxy or even smash them with floating asteroids. You just have to convince the boys that they should like you more. Unlike the successful Eastern Front, Gossip saw a very, very limited release in 1983. To Crawford, it was a design exercise never meant to be a product, and to that end, its existence in digital form is easy to validate, but the physical game is elusive and hard to find. Chris Crawford's last game for Atari was Excalibur, and boy was this a doozy. This is probably one of my favorite games on the Atari 800. It's an epic combination of every other game he created prior, war, economics, politics, and even interpersonal relations. The instruction manual describes the game like this. In Camelot, young Arthur has begun his reign as king. After more than 20 years of petty, bloody wars fought by upstarts and pretenders, the united Britain his father once ruled has been splintered into shards. Now Arthur, the rightful monarch, has come to restore peace, order, and good government. Armed only with his magic sword, Excalibur, guided only by his intuition and the spells of Merlin, he must weld these tiny warring kingdoms into a great nation. Back in 1984, I found Excalibur to be a sweeping epic. I poured dozens of hours into it, trying to find its secrets. I fought battles, made policies, tapped Merlin for help, and watched the interpersonal relationships of Camelot play out around the round table. It's still one of my top 10 Atari 8-bit games, and one of the few games of the time I ever played that truly delivered on the promise of what a computer game could be. In the guise of a grand strategy game, it was probably the first of its kind, only matched in the mid-80s by the likes of Seven Cities of Gold by Danny Button and Sid Meier's Pirates. And that was the end of Crawford's games for Atari. Atari folded in 1984, and he moved on to other things. Crawford's next game was probably his best game ever, Balance of Power. I recently picked up a copy of Balance of Power. I'm going to show you what it looks like right now.
Okay, here I have a brand new, fresh copy of Balance of Power by Chris Crawford, the 1990 edition from Mindscape. It's brand new, it's got the shrink wrap on it, and I'm going to open this up and let's see what it's like.
Very interesting.
Take this off. I'm glad that if you see the sticker stayed on, best political game, home office computing, best games of 1988, Atari ST Mega, 1 megabyte memory required, dual-sided disk drive required. That's the front of the box. Here's the back of the box as it runs in the, I think, medium res mode or also in high res mode. One of the few games that does that. It feels like it's a two-part box, but it's not. It's a single-part box. When you open it up, inside, there is. That's just a holder. And then as well, we've got the Balance of Power diskette for 1040 ST and Mega ST, and the 1990 edition Balance of Power rulebook. And this, Chris Crawford's magnum opus.
For Balance of Power, first, Crawford considered making another war game. Then he thought better of it. A child of the 60s, he was no fan of actual war and realized it was time he faced that reality. He described Balance of Power as his un-war game. In early notes, he described it this way. The game would be serious, it would be educational, and I think it would grab a great deal of attention. It would not be action-packed, but I think the launching of Armageddon would be far more wrenching in this game than Missile Command ever was. The game starts with a map of the world, highlighting hot zones, where red revolutions are taking place. Your job is to use America's hard and soft power to win the Cold War against the USSR. As soon as the title screen shows, you know you're in for something different, something truly Crawfordian. In an RTFM moment, pulling from Scram, where he wanted people to read the manual, the title screen says, "People who play this game without reading the manual are wasting their time." At first, the game seems easy. Just read the news to figure out who is on the side of the USSR, government or rebels, and then fund the other side. You can send indirect or direct military aid, economic aid, form treaties, etc. But it's much deeper than that. When you see a colored zone, you may jump in to do something, just like in any other game, but this is not any other game. Sometimes the best course of action is to do nothing, or plan to do something, but wait to see what the USSR does. Many times the USSR will back down from what they're doing, but sometimes they do not. If you take things too far, you could end up causing a nuclear war simply by, for example, standing your ground on a Burmese insurgency response. Was that worth World War III? And when you do, the following screen is displayed, a screen that has haunted me ever since I first saw it when I played in 1988. It says, "You have ignited a nuclear war." And no, there is no animated display of a mushroom cloud with parts of bodies flying through the air. We do not reward failure. Obviously, Crawford's tenure at Atari had changed him. He began his work there making action games on the Atari 2600 similar to Missile Command, but 4 years later, he was ready to create grand games that dealt with serious topics. But would anyone care? Since Eastern Front, he had not made a game that resonated with the public. Balance of Power has elements of many of Crawford's other games that came before it. You can feel the relationship tensions of Gossip, Brewing, and Excalibur as well below the surface as the USA and USSR battle for dominance in the mid-80s Cold War era. The Lost Cause Doom of Eastern Front is there too, but at the same time it feels wholly original, like a magnum opus of sorts. Crawford had a very difficult time getting game publishers interested in Balance of Power. But an article in InfoWorld by Scott Mace, published August 27, 1984, helped move things along. In the article, Mace wrote of Crawford, "In a world populated by video games that extol violence, Crawford is an anomaly. He is uncompromisingly demanding toward his own games and the works of others. Like other designers, he hopes to turn computer games into art. So far, his work is pointing in the right direction. Through computer software, laced with the language of war, he speaks a message of peace." Soon, Mindscape picked up the game and took a chance publishing it. It became a sizable hit, spending months on the Computer Entertainer Top 20 list in 1986, generating over $10 million in sales. It cemented Crawford as one of the first true auteurs of 80s computer games. The game was released for the Apple Macintosh first and was also one of the first games for Microsoft Windows. The Atari ST version was released in 1987. Like most of Crawford's games, Balance of Power still holds up today. Beyond the graphics and user interface, it's quite enjoyable to beat the USSR or USA for prestige by making the correct choices with influence and power. It taxes the brain in a way the best computer game experience of the era could muster. Sadly, Balance of Power was pretty much the last game Chris Crawford released on an Atari platform. He was not done, though. His next game was even more experimental. Cyboot, or full title Trust and Betrayal, The Legacy of Cyboot, took all of this to another level of abstraction. But sadly, it was only released on the Macintosh, and while it garnered good reviews, the quirky design that mixed AI with aliens, auras, and influence did not sell particularly well. In his book on game design, Crawford explained it this way. "It seemed that computer games were about to emerge phoenix-like from the ashes of video games and blossom into a true mass medium. Cyboot pushed the trend to its most extreme limit, and Mindscape, the distributors, and retailers lost their nerve. Cyboot went too far. There were easier sales to be made with more traditional products. The failure of Cyboot marked the end of the wildly experimental phase following the collapse of Atari in 1984. I did not recognize it at the time. I don't think anybody did, but the industry was committing itself to becoming a smaller, high-profit hobby rather than a mass medium," which it remained for a long time. He then tried to return to commercial success with a series of straight-ahead war and strategy games, but most of them were not commercial hits. By the mid-1990s, after starting the Game Developer Conference, then being forced out over his controversial ideas on games, Crawford left the game industry completely and spent the next 35 years or so trying to perfect the social relationship concepts he pioneered in Gossip, the same ones that fueled Excalibur and the underlying strategy in Balance of Power. His 1993 GDC presentation named The Dragon Speech said it all. Crawford described it on his website like this. "This is, without a doubt, the finest lecture I have ever given. It was my way of explaining to the industry why I felt it necessary to go off in a new direction. That direction, it turned out, was interactive storytelling, and this shows how far ahead of my time I was." Here's a short excerpt where Crawford commits to slay the dragon. "The reality in which Don Quixote lived was a sordid and ugly reality. The people were scrabbling for survival. He didn't want that. He wanted to live in a world where there was truth and human dignity and, yes, love. And try as he might, he couldn't accommodate that to the real world. Other people were able to compromise enough to reach an accommodation. Don Quixote, for him, the gap was too great. He couldn't bridge it, so instead of giving up on it, he imposed his reality onto the real world. Where other people saw a filthy country hostel, he saw a castle. Where other people saw a flock of sheep, he saw a mighty army. Where other people saw a windmill, he saw a dragon. Yes, Don Quixote was a crazy old fool. You know, he was more honest about his dreams than most people, and for that, I honor him. So the time has come for me to make my commitment. I have committed myself. I have dedicated myself to the pursuit of the dragon. I really can't do justice to this with a few screenshots and my own lame recitation to really understand the depths of passion of Crawford's commitment to his dream of interactive storytelling. You need to go watch the video of his speech from 1993. After that, Crawford took himself out of game development, but people, even people like myself, did try to drag him back in, even if he didn't want to be there. Over the years, he gained an undeserved reputation as a computer game naysayer, when in reality, he just wanted to follow his own heart and dream of creating interactive experiences about people, not things.
I have not made any effort whatsoever to teach people about games in 15 years. Single public the books that I published, I published three books. One was on interactivity, which I'm very well versed to write about. Another was on interactive storytelling, which I'm very well versed to write about. And the third was on games, and publisher approached me, new writers approached me and said, geez, we'd really like you to do this book. So I said, yeah, sure. And so I make no attempt to teach about, you know, the current generation of games. All of my public presentations have been at the request of the host. I have never gone out and looked for any of these. Just call me up, and they want me to talk. In a couple of cases, I've told them I haven't done a game in years. Hey, well, we still want you.
In that time, he watches ideas get watered down into big-selling yet soulless endeavors like The Sims that took only the most base aspects of his concept of social relationships and used them for the computer equivalent of fart jokes. He stuck to his guns, though, with the goal to create a set of tools that would allow storytellers to build true interactive fiction devoid of the trappings of computer games, allowing for complex interactions and deep relationships. In the early 2000s, long before the current indie games industry, Chris Crawford envisioned a way for regular people with wild ideas to try to make games, a true democratization of game development.
They spend millions of dollars making a game, and there's no cheap, easy way to build a good game that can, you know, get a fair shot in the market. And so that means they've eliminated one of their best sources of creative input, which is all the crazy people out there. The model I like to use for this, Hollywood has it nailed down, and the games industry really should learn from Hollywood here, although it's probably too late now. Basically, there are 8 million people, survey show, 8 million people in this country will tell pollsters, yes, I have an idea for a novel that I want to write. Out of those 8 million, a few hundred thousand, apparently, actually, every year, write something. And out of those few hundred thousand, I think it's something like 10,000 actually produce a manuscript that they ship to a publisher.
Wow.
And out of those 10,000, only a few hundred are published. And out of those few hundred, only a handful actually, you know, the big time.
Make money.
Yeah, they make a lot of money. Most of them actually make a little money. But, you know, maybe a dozen make a goodly amount of money. And out of those dozen, one or two will be cherry-picked by Hollywood to make into a movie. So think of the pyramid. Creative base is 8 million ideas, and at each level, there's a selection going on that knocks out 98% of everything, and it's a sorting system that picks the very, very best for the full treatment.
The result was Storytron, a tool to allow writers and designers to get their visions into interactive form.
And you've been working on this idea, this Storytron idea, that came out of the relationships you actually created in Excalibur, right? What is the breakthrough that finally came upon you to get Storytron ready to go?
There were a whole bunch of major developments that I had to make, and that's one reason why it's taken 15 years. If it were just one technology I had to build, then it would have been done years ago. Moreover, there's a strong synergistic relationship among these various components, and so I couldn't see them all at once. I mean, I started off building the basic engine, and that in itself was that was a breakthrough. The way that engine worked and the way it handled drama and people and so forth, yes, that was a breakthrough, but it was only one, and by itself it was insufficient. And I didn't realize that. Its biggest problem was that it was very difficult to program the engine, to give the engine the data it needed to tell good stories. So the engine I did between 91 and about 94, 95. The next big breakthrough was building the editor that allowed a user to, in effect, program the engine, to develop the data set required for the engine, because that's a very complex data set, and it's hard. And it took me years to do that, because I had to build a scripting language. And the fundamental requirement was that this, I mean, if I were just writing a scripting language for programmers, it would have been trivial. I could have knocked it off in, you know, a few months, because everybody's done that. But my requirement was that this had to be something accessible to non-technical people.
By 2005, I pretty much lost track of Chris Crawford. He still occupied space in my brain, though, but his relative absence from the mainstream had taken its toll on my memory of him. Looking for game design books that year, I happened upon On Game Design and found it an absolutely fascinating read. I found his contact information and was able to schedule a game design training with him. Jeff and I talked about meeting with Chris Crawford on that unreleased podcast from 2020.
We met Chris Crawford once. We did. We were working together at an entertainment company, and we were working with a team that was starting to build lots of games for their brands.
Yes.
And these were flash games mostly, and we brought him in to teach the team about game design.
And it was awesome.
It was fascinating.
It was the most fascinating, I think, 8 hours I've ever spent sitting in a room.
To understand just how detailed and in-depth yet fascinating a talk by Chris Crawford can be, here's an excerpt from the book, Understanding Interactivity, which he had just finished when he did our seminar.
From Chapter 25, A History in Interactivity. It all started long ago, before DOS, before television, before cavemen. Mother Nature was screwing around with a new kind of critter, the mammal. And the basic design looked pretty versatile. On a whim, she tried giving some of the mammals bigger brains and more intelligence, and lo and behold, it worked. Critters with bigger brains seemed to do better. But at a certain point, the brains got so big that a problem emerged. What do you put in those brains? Mother Nature had gotten pretty handy cooking up various systems that could detect, analyze, and respond to all manner of complicated environmental situations. Herbivore brains could combine sensory information from ears and eyes to detect approaching predators, analyze their motion, and plot the best route of escape. Later, she concocted some snazzy evasion algorithms that permitted prey to zig and zag with just the right timing to throw off closely pursuing predators. But these were all hardwired into the synapses. The critical information about how to do these things was encoded into the DNA, and the critter was born with the ability. The bigger brains she was experimenting with were capable of all sorts of snazzy calculations, but bigger brains need more data, and that's what raised the problem. She was getting tired of hand-coding DNA with all those complicated neural algorithms. More important, she realized that she couldn't keep going this way forever. Eventually, she'd run out of DNA for all these algorithms, and the new 256 megabyte RAM were a long ways off. She fiddled around aimlessly for a few eons, trying various combinations, none of which seemed to work. Then she stumbled onto the solution, with one of the minor orders, probably Felix. That's the cat's. The big idea was this. Don't bother programming the brain with all the behavioral techniques and algorithms. Instead, program the brain with the basics, eating, drinking, sleeping, walking, and that kind of thing, and then add a special behavior whose function is to learn new behaviors, a behavior to learn behaviors. What a concept.
It was after this, as I alluded to in the introduction, that Crawford inspired me to make my first in-depth games. While those games were nakedly commercial and not exactly the types of games Crawford would make himself, I can't deny that he had a huge impact on my desire to make those games in the first place, and likewise, his drive to forge his own way and follow his own dream has been a huge inspiration for me ever since. Over the past 17 years, through multiple iterations of Storytron, a return to Cyboot, and his last finished game in the genre, La Mort d'Arthur, Chris Crawford has tried to create tools and experiences that bring the concepts of complex interpersonal relationships into the world of games and interactivity. But still, the results have not lived up to his expectations. In a blog post from his website dated June 29, 2025, entitled The End of an Era, I spent about 10 years in Storytron and a great deal of my money hiring contractors to do some of the work that I couldn't do. And it was all for nothing. Storytron was too complicated for the audience. I don't think that was because it was intrinsically too complicated for anybody to understand. My impression is that there just weren't any people willing to make the big commitment required to learn how to use Storytron. After taking his final design of his interactive fiction engine to an interactive fiction conference and received absolutely no response, he wrote this. And so it is time for me to admit that, after all those decades of work, I have failed. With the single exception of La Mort d'Arthur. When I designed for myself, I succeeded. When I designed for others, I failed. It's time to throw in the towel and leave interactive storytelling to others. I don't think that the world is ready. You can still play Crawford's last finished game, La Mort d'Arthur, online. It is a strange but fully enjoyable experience. It feels exactly like you'd expect. It's a text-based version of Excalibur, mixed with the social aspects of gossip and the political intrigue of Balance of Power, but taken to an almost extreme level. If you'd like to see the mind of a genius expressing itself after 40 years of frustration, I suggest you play the game now. On that final blog, Chris Crawford explained La Mort d'Arthur like this. In 2020, for my 70th birthday, I realized I was growing old and would not be able to handle a tough technical challenge much longer. I therefore decided that the time had come for me to make one last effort, and that effort had to be an Arthurian game. I reread the many Arthurian books that I had accumulated during the previous efforts, girded my loins, and set to work. I made many changes along the way. The final version of La Mort d'Arthur was quite unlike the original, but it worked. I knew that. After all these years, I'd finally achieved my goal of making genuine, interactive art. I was proud, tired, and gratified. Not many people played the story world, but I didn't care. That was the world's failure, not mine. I experienced La Mort d'Arthur for an extended time when it first came out. It was a fascinating mix of story, dialogue, and choices where the outcome was not easy to foresee. As it progresses, the options get more and more intricate, and the situations tangled and murky. There are no puzzles or enemies, just choices that lead to more choices and more. While playing, I could not help but feel like Crawford had finally achieved what he set out to do 40 years ago. The legendary Alan Kay asked Crawford to dream, in Atari research. And that is exactly what he did. Removed from the trappings of what made a game with no rules and only his intellect and wonder to drive him, Chris Crawford, to me, the first auteur game designer, set out to make experiences that, in his words, were based on people, not things. It was a winding path, and even if few people saw the results, he finally achieved what he set out to do. The title page for La Mort d'Arthur includes the following words that are pure Crawfordian. It's not a game. It's not interactive fiction. It's not a puzzle. It's not action-packed. It's not fun. If you are a gamer, you'll hate it and should not play it. If you like interactive fiction, you probably won't like it. It's mostly text with some illustrations. It's art. And as a longtime Chris Crawford fan, I suggest you go try La Mort d'Arthur before it disappears forever. While it's possible Chris Crawford does not think his life's work amounted to anything, I would beg to differ in the loudest and most obvious way. My own games, once purely commercial efforts and now just hobby experiments, have taken a turn as I reached the age Crawford was when I first met him. For instance, the worst game, an Atari 2600 title, was designed to defend the competence of early Atari 2600 programmers, while Balance, an Atari 7800 experiment, was designed as a way to deal with the death of my childhood friend Brandon. These games are ostensibly about people, not things. And oddly enough, I never realized that connection to Crawford until this very moment. To me, Crawford is many things. One of the first real indie game developers, one of the first authors who wrote about how to make games, one of the first designers who truly strove to make games that could be considered art, one of the first people to strive for the democratization of game development, and one of the first to see a dark path forward for the AAA game industry. Notice, not one of these is failure. Crawford is one of my true heroes, but that's not enough in this situation. His ideas on games thrive today as the major players in the game industry falter from churning out the same content over and over, just like you warned about, while indie games thrive on itch.io, Steam, and in homebrew circles. Games now come in any and all forms, with ideas presented in very artistic and non-conformist ways, many of them built with tools designed so every person can have the chance to make games. I know these are not the exact same things as real interactive storytelling, the kind that Crawford wanted to make, but it doesn't mean he's failed. Maybe he thinks he's failed because large language models appear to do some of the same interactive fiction functions he was trying to build, but in reality, that is far from the truth. LLMs are surface level, operate on statistics, and can only provide a very thin and unrewarding experience without heavy intervention from a story design tool like Storytron. What an LLM can produce on its own is nothing like the 5 to 8 hour engrossing story of something like La Mort d'Arthur. While his latest work may not have lived up to his own expectations, a failure is certainly not how I could describe Chris Crawford. A man cannot judge his entire life on just the last thing he has tried to build. He needs to judge himself on his total effect on other people. People over things. And for me, and for the legacy of Atari and the computer game industry, I believe that net total effect has been overwhelmingly positive. And no matter what happened with Storytron, it's not failure. Because in his assessment of his very own work, going against everything he knows to be true, by saying he failed, Chris Crawford has prioritized things like Storytron over the people who have learned from and been inspired by him. And that's the enigma of Chris Crawford.
We will were children of the Silicon Revolution, an X generation conscripted to fight the console and home computer wars. A product of an analog 70s childhood, we came of digital age in the 80s, believing we could affect the world 8 bits at a time. Armed with joysticks, full stroke keyboards, Jolt Cola, and MTV haircuts, we proceeded into the vertical blank. There, we stayed up late at night, devising incantations from D&D rulebooks and beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code. Video games were the match, and programming was the fuse, as the infinite possibilities of the digital world exploded into the internet age to come. We are Generation Atari.
Into the vertical blank.